Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 204, Science Faction Homo Floresiensis.
Flores, is this like the Latin lover of the Homo family?
Yeah, he's really suave. He's got this like kind of pencil-thin mustache.
You gotta roll the R. Flores.
This is, of course, The Hobbit. This particular hominid has a great place in my heart. It was actually discovered while I was in my undergrad, and I got to be part of this whole big hubbub and around the paleoanthropological community as it was going on. So this guy lived in one spot, the island of Flores in Indonesia, and as his nickname, The Hobbit, implies, he was very short, about 3.5 feet tall. Now, this is in our own genus. This is
so
Homo.
Every guy on Tinder, basically.
Yeah. Every guy who shot from like a weird angle on Tinder.
Tom Cruise would be tall in this community.
He was, like I said, 3.5 feet tall. The species almost certainly overlapped in time and space with our own, which is Homo sapien, as they were making their way through the Indonesian islands. There was most likely some kind of overlap, though they did not, because they existed very late in hominid history, probably one of the latest ones to exist, though they did not exist as late as we thought they did, or at least we don't have evidence of it. When these were first found back in 2004, they postulated that these guys were around up until about 14,000 years ago. That date has been revised to about 50 to 60,000 years ago.
That's more like it.
Yeah, but that still kind of overlaps when people are coming through there. So that's kind of cool. Imagine this 3.5 foot tall person running around. He's got tools. He's making fire. You know, this isn't some base creature. This is just like a weird little hobbit person who's running around the forest.
How big were we? Was Homo sapien at
six
this
feet
point?
Tall.
We were around 6 feet tall at this point?
Yeah.
I'm like... I was thinking about the pairing because you said we've crossbred with them. And it just seems devastating.
No. We don't know that.
We're wildly unsatisfying.
No, I don't think we crossbred with them. We could have, but we have no evidence of
we
that.
We just beat them in basketball.
Yeah. But they kicked our ass in limbo. So they had these super tiny brains, 380 cc's, which, as you guys have been paying attention as we go through all the other hominids, that's super low. That's lower than a lot of the Australopithecines. That doesn't make sense. And that created this huge controversy because people were like, what the fuck is this thing? Face and the skull look a lot like Homo. And so it has to be in our genus. It looks a lot like Homo erectus, but it has this tiny brain. Tiny. So remember we talked about Homo erectus being sometimes as high as 1100 cc's. This is down at 380. This is super, super low. This is actually at, or actually just a little bit below where chimps are.
But it was the rest of its brain that was smaller, not the frontal cortex, right?
Right. So that's an interesting little side note, is there's one part of the frontal cortex that was actually more normal size. It almost looks as big as it does in humans, but it is in a different animal. So it seemingly has shrunk in a weird way. Now, there was some paleoanthropologists when this first came out that was floating these ridiculous theories. Oh, this isn't another species. This is a microcephalic human. Microcephaly, we talked about that in relation to Zika. It's where the brain shrinks and you have this basically a malformation. It's a pathology. Well, we've excavated quite a few of these guys from this cave, and actually one from somewhere else nearby. You didn't have a bunch of microcephalic people that just happened to live in the same place over tens of thousands of years. That's not what it was. It was a silly argument. The real argument, though, there is a legitimate argument as to where this came from. The leading theory is Homo erectus. You have Homo erectus making its way through Southeast Asia at the time, which we know it did. We have tools there that appear to be from Homo erectus at 1 million years ago. It gets trapped on the island as the water levels rise and turn this peninsula into an island. And what happens to mammals on island is called insular dwarfism, where essentially we shrink.
That happens really slowly, though, right? Like the waters come up and they're like, we could just go back over, but we like it here.
They can't. Maybe they walked over and they don't have boating technology, you know?
Yeah, but it doesn't rise that fast that far, right?
And it surpassed. They have short legs, but they couldn't wade through it for the first couple days.
Well, some of them probably did, which is why there was Homo erectus, you know, in the
mainland.
First couple
decades. Yeah. Like, it didn't take a couple of days.
All it
right?
takes is one little subpopulation to stick there for long enough, and then all of a sudden they're stuck, and that's where they're going to be.
They liked their house.
Yeah. They're in a real carpe diem species. Maybe this is why we don't see it. Like, we'll move tomorrow.
They're like the hurricane survivors in Florida. We're not moving. Yeah. We're staying. We're going to build on the floodplain. We're going to rebuild.
That's exactly what they are. And they stayed there for a long time, and they did quite well for themselves. So there you go. There are some other ideas that is not what it was, that these are actually remnants of a much older hominid that made its way there. Some think maybe even Australopithecine, though we've never found an Australopithecine outside of Africa, not even close. Some think maybe it's an Australopithecine or a very, very early Homo, like very, very early Homo habilis or early Homo erectus. that made it out there. And they think that because it has some interesting body morphology, the angles of the arm bones, some certain wrist bones, the way the shoulders are kind of hunched in, those all are more for a brachial or an animal that's going in through the trees. So it looks more primitive in a lot of ways. And so because of that, some people postulate that it's maybe from a much older hominid. We're not sure. What we do know is how this thing lived its life. Again, it had fire, it had stone tools, both very interesting, and it hunted tiny elephants. So much like the humans got to this island and shrunk, when elephants get on islands, and this happens all the time, it happened at Wrangel Island in northern Russia, it happened here on the Channel Islands off California, elephants or proboscideans got to these islands, they got stranded there, and then when the water came up, there wasn't enough food for them, so slowly, through natural selection, they shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, and they became quite small.
Tackle it, or is it like a cow?
You could, smaller than a cow. I don't think you could tackle it because it's probably stout. But these were, you know, a few, I think they were like 3.5-4 feet high.
So mammals that are relegated to islands shrink.
Yes, but a lot of times lizards grow.
Because
so
the water's cold.
Because the water's cold?
Yeah, no. Everything's smaller and
colder. Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. There was shrinkage! Don't judge me by this!
So wait, like there were elephants essentially the size of pigs, like a potbelly pig.
Maybe bigger than a pig, but yeah, there were let's say like dwarf pony type things, and yes, they were killing these things and eating them, and that was how they lived. They had fire and stuff. Very, very interesting. There's a few interesting.
It sounds like they'd be just like us if they weren't trapped on an island.
Yeah, and again, 380 cc's.
Not us, but their equivalent. Yeah,
yeah, that's still going to be, you know, they're going to have some kind of inhibition of their brains. And to back up some of the ideas, they actually found more recently a fossil of this species on the same island, Flores. A little bit further away from it, and this one dated back to 700,000 years ago, and it was even smaller than the ones that are at 60,000 years, indicating that if it got stuck, Homo erectus got stuck on the island, it shrank very quickly. So it got stuck there maybe a million years ago, shrinks rather quickly, and then actually grows a little bit since then. So some really interesting stuff, but there's some really interesting backstories to it too, which are arguably even more interesting, which is we have to remember that paleoanthropology is a very unique discipline. It's unlike physics, it's unlike chemistry, in that you can't just have a lab and do the same work you're doing in Russia and Brazil and China anywhere else as long as you have the funding and the tools and the supplies. Paleoanthropology requires you to have the specific fossils that you're trying to study. Those fossils become property of the nation by which they're acquired, even if outside nations or outside researchers are doing the work there. So what happened is these researchers are doing this work in Flores. They excavate a bunch of stuff. They find this new species. It's a big deal. The bones are incredibly fragile. A lot of times the bones were like kind of like wet paper, the consistency of wet paper, because this is not a great fossilization environment. It's very wet. They excavate it. They very carefully take these out. They're stored in kind of a government facility. And there's
by
top men. There's a guy out there named Teku Jacob. He's the godfather of paleoanthropology for Indonesia. He is their guy. He's their superstar. He's their Tim White. And he basically went to the government and said, oh, hey, you know those guys who dug up those bones? Let me see those bones. Takes them out of the repository, takes them to his lab, no permission. During this time, he ends up losing two of the leg bones, shatters the pelvis, which tells us a lot about bipedal walking, lifestyles, and other things like that. And
yeah, he shattered it.
Yeah.
High five.
And then he snaps the jaw in half while making a cast. And then
yeah, he did.
It was a small little guy, right?
And what the fuck is this guy doing?
He's fucking incompetent. And it's so infuriating because we don't have more of these, right? Again, this isn't physics. You can't recreate element 118 to try and do it later. This is the only ones we have. He cuts into the bones a bunch when he makes molds and then has to cut them off. And he does them like an insane primitive person. He has no idea what he's fucking doing. He trashes these remains. And then to top it off, when he gets confronted, he's just like, I don't know what happened. Screw you. Because the government of Indonesia is behind him, not only does he not suffer any consequences, but in order to keep him from being further embarrassed, the government of Indonesia forbade any more digging at the site until that guy died. So whatever theories he had couldn't be proved wrong in his lifetime. It is crazy.
Or maybe it was just to keep him away from that fucking site. Yeah. Like, we don't want him to fuck more shit up.
Stop fucking these skeletons, guys!
What if he was completely competent, but there just was a situation where he had to do a Weekend Bernie's-style thing in order to save his family, to save...
He had to put, like, coats and stuff on the skeleton and take it out and pretend it was alive? One of these horror stories of science, it's stuff that used to go on in all sciences 150 years ago. It's paleoanthropology is one of the only ones where it's continued into the 21st century. It's a really, really shitty little back corner of this particular field that most people don't talk about, but it is unfortunately the truth, and we've undoubtedly lost a lot of information because of that. And the story gets even better, because there's even one more interesting tidbit. I want everybody to take this with a grain of salt, because there's a lot of sensationalism in science, and I don't want to do that, and so I want you to take this with a grain of salt. But on this island of Flores, there has been a long-standing legend of something called the Ibu Gogo, which is basically these little guys who lived in the forest. The natives described them as hairy people who talked weird, who lived in the forest. And they were described as having lived there up until Portuguese contact. So we're talking about not up until 14,000 years ago, up until modern times, up until historical times.
Ibu Gogo is my new band.
Yeah. And think about that. How weird would that be? How crazy would it be if we found out that not only that happened, maybe there's still some remnant population way out in the middle of the island that we haven't gotten to yet that is still out there. You know, these are tiny little people who learn to avoid humans or interact with them. That is very, very interesting. Also, on the nearby island of Sumatra, there's the legend of the Orang Pendek, which a lot of times has been thought to be something very similar. They would talk about the old man or the small little man of the woods. He lived there and he talked weird, and they have weird little culture and they have tools, but they're more primitive than us. It was written off later in historical times as being an orangutan. People thought, oh, they're just talking about orangutans, which live on Sumatra. But...
And orangutans only do sign language, so they know...
That's true.
That must be...
That they only do sign language so and play third base with Joey from Friends.
That was a chip, you asshole.
Was it?
Not all apes.
Hashtag not all apes.
But there is a possibility that these people are describing some kind of remnant population, maybe now a dead population, but a recently alive population of a Flores-type creature running around that we haven't discovered. It would be so amazing if we ever discovered a hominid still alive, a non-human hominid still alive. That would absolutely blow the doors off it. I doubt that's very likely. We don't find new land-based megafauna very often. The only time we find new species of them is when we go, oh, the thing we thought was one species is actually two. Like,
it'd be extra great if he could tell you where he came from.
Right?
700,000 years ago.
I've just been hiding in that cave for a while, bro.
How he got there. Like, well, they came up. We got isolated. We didn't feel like crossing the little river.
We've already sent our Hobbit Homo Flores ambassador out to you guys. Did he not tell you about us? His name was Seacrest.
He's at the UN. He's at the UN. You just can't see him above the desk. He's too short. He's been there the whole time.
Hello, Jane Goodall here, walking by.
Damn it, Jane.
Yes, I'd like to. You've called me crazy on the show for believing in Sasquatch many times. Yeah. How come if I say I can commune with the Sasquatch, I'm crazy Jane Goodall who's revolutionized my field in science?
Yep.
Whereas story fables about an ancient hobbit people that talked, you give credence to that.
I don't give credence to that. It's still probably not likely that there's any alive or that they made it very long, but this is an area with poor fossilized preservation because it's humid, so they could very well have made it into historical times and died out without us knowing because their bones would most likely would not be preserved. However, we're pretty sure there's no Sasquatches running around North America.
Well, I would disagree. We're one skeleton away. You believe there's a Homo floresiensis? Because you find one skeleton, I believe there's a Sasquatch because I'm a size queen, and I have to believe it's true. All right.
Try Loch Ness.
Ooh, I like you. You're sassy, madame. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Jane.
And speaking of insane scientists, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy, and with me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. We're the podcast that gets the big names.
That's right.
And let's see Star Talk get Jane Goodall.
Yeah, especially let's see them get Jane Goodall and get her to talk about her pan-species sex life.
I could bring Ken Ham in here right now if you want Ken Ham.
And our scientist for the evening, Allison Gill. Allison, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Fantastic. And I just want to plug real quick, you have your own podcast. Now, we are, of course, a nonpartisan podcast. You've probably never been able to even tell what our political points of view are if you listen to this show. But there is a political podcast that you host, Allison. What's that called?
It's called Mueller, She Wrote.
Which is, by the way, awesome name.
Thank you.
The podcast sucks, you should listen to it just because that name is sweet.
Well, I mean, this plug is starting off terribly. Why would you even put sucks into the mind of the fan?
That's true.
A wonderful podcast. All things Mueller investigation. I've listened to every episode. All five?
Five, yeah. Six goes up Monday.
Exactly.
Okay. And you, of course, are doing that podcast about famous UC Berkeley physicist Richard Mueller.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Fair enough.
Exactly. He was actually about what he thinks.
He was my physics professor, so I'm happy now.
Oh, cool.
We can bring that in.
Adjunct or...
And of course, you can go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to. And I also want to give a shout out to podcastmind.com, which gave us a very nice review. It was five awesome podcasts that you will learn something when you listen to. We got up there with Radiolab, which as I must think that they are as disgusted to be mentioned in the same breath as us, as we are excited to be mentioned in the same breath as them.
And Car Talk is in there too.
The lady who wrote the article said that her favorite part of the show was I Call BS.
Yes, she did.
Which is a show, despite my 8-game, let's call it 100-game, because this game's all about fucking exaggerating shit. But despite that, her favorite section is essentially an apartheid against my people.
Which
that's
I
her.
Love. She, like everybody, loves the game I Call BS. And I put a little comment on her page thanking her for doing that and telling her that I would make sure I brought it up to you. And then she mentioned you're probably just angry about it because you always lose. So
literally on a win streak right now, despite these horrible rules.
And speaking of a special promotion we did a while ago, Damien said anybody who comes and writes a favorable review on iTunes, Damien's going to roast whatever you want them to roast. We got an entry for the country of Denmark. So Damien, if you will take away your Denmark roast.
Yeah, I'm roasting the land of Jaime Lannister and Marmaduke. By the way, I will roast anything. It's not just a nation. I'll roast myself if you want.
Literally, he will crawl into a pit of hot coals.
And not come out till I'm tender. Fun fact, the Danish language has no word for please. Or consent. Denmark. Sweden's pudgy, drunk little brother. Denmark has laws that prevent you from naming your child something unseemly, like anus. Yet there is no law to prevent you from naming your anus child.
How'd you know?
Damien's searches for child sex are really going to screw him over.
Yeah, do not Google child anus, please.
It's kind of a win-win situation for me. I mean, it's like a good consolation prize, I feel
like. You hear
me,
Roy Moore? Stay out of it.
Denmark, a nation that thinks itself to be progressive, but whose second largest ethnic group is snowmen. And even they have to drink at separate fountains. Fun fact, Bluetooth devices got their name from the second king of Denmark, King Harald Bluetooth. However, they almost named it after their fifth king, King the N-word.
All right, let's do one more.
Many people find it difficult to tell the difference between a person from Denmark and a person from Sweden. Here's the secret. The person from Sweden will be on top.
Oh, God. First of all, I love that Denmark asked us to roast them. Denmark is one of my favorite countries on earth. Copenhagen is my absolute favorite city on earth. I love the Danish people. They're awesome. It's one of the only places you go and you can speak English and everybody else speaks English, even though that's not their native tongue.
That's pretty much everywhere in Europe, though.
Do that in Paris. See how people treat you.
They can. Yeah. They're just dicks.
Yeah.
You don't like my American flag shirt? What's the problem?
I visited Copenhagen once and immediately declared that I'm going to move there someday because it's absolutely amazing.
I lived in Germany for a while, and when I went to, as a student, when we went to Paris, I accidentally was speaking German to the people in France with an American accent. That didn't go over very well at all either.
No, the Danish are great. They have an amazing public transportation system. They have bike highways, and they have this great thing called Christiania, where they allowed a bunch of people to just squat in an old abandoned government base in the middle of their downtown city, and they've been running their own society with no laws for the past 35 years.
I am the ambassador for Denmark, and I would like to recruit Robert Timothy to come to our country. You are only the third most funny person on this comedy science podcast, but in our nation, you would be at least the third funniest person in our nation.
That's true.
You sound eerily German.
I am an American doing a German accent. I thought you guys were French.
Bring us by, Denmark. Tell a bunch of your friends. Get a bunch of Danish followers. We'll come on out there for a show or something. All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one, there's a gay gene.
Gene Wilder was married to Gilda Radner. Yes, I could see how some manly man might have looked at the role of Willy Wonka as feminine at the time, but it holds up.
It's not actually a gay gene, but there's some very, very interesting research that just got published, which looked at two big broad data sets of men and compared their self-reported sexual identity, gay or straight, to their genetic makeup. And they found two specific areas on two chromosomes that seem to be associated with homosexuality. Without getting into all the causation, correlation, this, that, and the other, it does look very promising that these particular gene groups might actually be what we would consider a genetic basis for homosexuality. That's really, really important and really, really interesting. So, male sexual orientation is moderately heritable, probably about 30 to 40%, but there's a lot of stuff that comes in. There's multi-genes that work together, there's environmental factors, there's a bunch of stuff that obviously work with that.
Losing bets.
Yeah.
And the reason that they were studying men in this particular, as opposed to women, right, and men, is, you, I think...
Well, there's two things. One is the data set was men. But the second one, the reason they haven't gone out and done the female one as much, and they do need to go back and do this, is, in general, self-reportingly, men tend to report very binary, gay, straight. Women tend to report much more of the spectrum. Now, in reality, men are probably on that spectrum too, but for cultural reasons, they don't want to report it in that sense. And then also, there might be a biological instance where they're not as spectrum-y. Who knows? But in this particular case, they were looking at men.
So we don't know if they're genealogically more binary or just self-reportingly,
exactly,
more binary?
Exactly. We can't tell, okay, that. We can't tell that yet. It might be both. You know, a lot of these things tend to be nature and nurture mixed together.
We all start as women, so.
We do. We do all start.
As early as this morning.
She breaks somebody's jaw again.
So one of these regions, gene named SLITRK6, can be found on chromosome number 13. And the other region is a gene called TSHR and was identified on chromosome number 14. The variants of these genes seem to have some kind of influential impact on whether or not a male is homosexual. This doesn't mean that that person is absolutely going to be gay, because again, there's a lot of other factors. Genes interact in different ways. We have environmental factors, but this seems to be a real big indicator.
Have they looked at animals too? Because sloths, no, are pretty gay.
Are they? Are sloths gay?
No, I don't. I'm just saying.
I was going to say, like, I feel like gays have too much energy for a sloth. They'd be like, hey, get out of here. I'm going to go dance.
Imagine a sloth gay pride parade. It's pretty boring.
Yeah. Damien has showed me some pictures of sloth bondage, so I could kind of imagine it.
Yeah, it's the guy from Goonies. It's way different.
That's what the S in BDSM stands for.
Bondage, domination, sloth, and masochism.
Yes.
Don't even know. I forgot my joke. That was good.
What's interesting is these genes have been linked to things like thyroid development, which sometimes we already know from other physiological studies differ in gay men and straight men. That's really interesting. One's previous study has actually shown an innate hyperactive thyroid issue is responsible for a body mass disproportion between certain gay men and straight men. Because basically they're skinny bitches, like their thyroid is always working. They literally have a smaller body mass based on a thyroid difference that they have from straight men. That's really interesting. This is the genetic basis of that thyroid difference.
Could you argue, let's say all three of us were three gay men sitting in a room and we decided to take a genetic test,
right,
to see if we had this gay gene.
So basically we're pretending that Allison's a gay man?
Yeah. She's allowed to role play. Yeah.
I'm more fluid than you guys.
That's
so
true.
She is. Let's say we all three took this genetic test and it turns out that you two had the gay gene. Could you argue that in a very positive way, I'm way gayer than you guys?
Yeah, you're trying.
I wanted,
you're putting
it,
the effort in. Right?
You guys were born with a silver dick in your ass, whereas I had to go out there every day. And
you might be like, I might consider you like the Rachel Dolezal of gays then. You're just jumping on the bandwagon. By the way, it's a super nice wagon. Bedazzled. So here's my question. Now that we can say, look, we have these genetic indicators, again, not 100%, but genetic indicators, should we be careful about what we do with this information? Because we know that there are governments that are fairly technologically advanced, including Russia and Iran, that have publicly said we can punish gay people for being gay. In Iran, you can actually be killed for it. If we allow this kind of information to get out, do we have to worry in the scientific community about publishing this type of information? Because if it gets out, this might be a way that these governments crack down on people literally for being born.
Now, I think it helps bolster the argument that this is nature,
right,
and not nurture, and therefore is an inherent thing, such as skin color, eye color, yeah, hair color, and therefore, you know, kind of backs the argument that it is discriminatory.
Right. And that would mean a lot in Western civilization, right? Because in Western civilization, we have a problem discriminating
in Western civilization
against people who are innately born a certain way. So you're right. That would help a lot of people in the United States and Europe and stuff. But are in doing that, are we hurting the gays in those other places who are now, we're putting a target that those governments
they're
can
They're already
at?
Fucked. In other, yeah. I mean, honestly.
Well, the bad part is a lot of times they can't get fucked.
Oh,
so
if these nations want to cede the design industry to nations like America, I'm sure like gay American designers, on one hand, are outraged by the persecution of their community. But on the other hand, in a globalized market, there are fewer nations competing in the design and other industries, fashion.
That's right. We'll win by keeping the gays. It'll be like what we did with Jews in World War II. You know, the Nazis were like, kill all the Jews. Oh, we forgot that they were most of our scientists. And the U.S. is like, give it to us. Give it to us. Well, that, and then think about even just locally. You know, there, it's not like we're, just because we're in the West, we're somehow above that type of prejudice.
I wonder if we'll then have gay refugees.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get all the gay refugees, and we, again, even Sloth Pride Parade will be good then. Oh, God. But even here in the Western world, we are getting more and more to the point where you can choose the child you're having, especially with in vitro technology. You can choose right now, do you want a boy or a girl when you're getting in vitro? You can choose right now, you can actually choose eye color and hair color. You can choose. If we get to the point where you can then choose, are you going to have this gay child or not? Would it be possible that we're going to have a whole lot of people choosing to not have gay children, and therefore you would basically have what a lot of people in the genetically deaf community call a genocide on them? There's a lot of people who in the genetically deaf community get angry at the fact that...
Like the eugenics people?
Kind of, yeah. Like you can scan for people who are genetically deaf and then choose not to have that baby. A lot of people in the deaf community get angry at that idea. I would think even more so with that gay analogy, you would have a lot of people in the Midwest who would choose not to have a gay kid. I mean, that is a fact. They don't have to be in Russia or Iran for that.
And that is not optimal. But on the plus side, a lot of these people who are in the South and Midwest are people who would come out against most sciences anyway. This is like these are people who come out against stem cell technology. Mm-hmm. This is somebody that gets them like pro-science.
It, they'll go in vitro because that'll make more kids.
But I can't, because in Christianity, it's in vitro is a no-no. But I can see them now saying, oh, well, if we can weed out the gays, then God would have wanted it that way.
And I would amend
all
it.
Right.
A lot of Christians are very pro in vitro as long as they don't dispose of any fertilized embryos. So there's actually a Christian form of in vitro where you don't have excess embryo.
But the point is they're so touchy about all this shit. Like you were saying, stem cell science, all this other stuff. But I bet if this came up, they would be all about.
Yep. Find the gays. Mm-hmm. All right. On to article number 2. Canola may be killing you. Very, very interesting study. This looked at canola oil, which is the cheapest form of vegetable oil that's available. It's commonly used for a lot of stuff. Now, this started because they were doing some experiments in mice with Alzheimer's genetic knockouts, basically meaning that these mice are genetically pre-programmed to have Alzheimer's disease.
What are the effects of a mouse with Alzheimer's?
A lot of cheese just laying around.
Do they forget their keys? Like, what happens?
Just start shouting racial slurs from a different time at random?
I mean, in reality, I don't even feel that bad for that mouse because he doesn't know what's going on. It's the mouse family that is really who suffers in mouse Alzheimer's.
It is the one who suffers. Yeah, like a little mouse notebook where they... let's recreate it.
Mouse notebook.
The Tom and Jerry cartoons are actually way funnier when the mouse has Alzheimer's. But long story short, they made these mouse Alzheimer's models, and they gave these ones olive oil at first, and they did these tests with olive oil, and it actually seemed to improve the Alzheimer's symptoms. It helped with some of the amyloid plaques that we find, which are problems in Alzheimer's. It helped with a lot of things, memory recall, everything. So they wanted to do the test again and say, hey, let's try canola oil. So they did this with canola oil, and they found the exact opposite. It led to more amyloid plaques, worse maze testing, worse memory recall, worse learning, gain in weight, all this stuff based on an adequate amount of canola oil in the diet. Now, a couple of things. One, it's a mouse model, so it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate to humans. Two, this is on creatures that already have Alzheimer's. So it doesn't mean that this gave them Alzheimer's. It doesn't mean that it would have the same effects on a healthy mouse. That's going to be a follow-up study they're going to have to do. But on these mice with Alzheimer's...
Do they give the mice Alzheimer's, or do they have, like, screening?
No, they haven't. They genetically... It's a genetic knockout. So they literally...
Like, they have interviews.
From birth...
They took a mini mental, like every
exactly. Okay, we got to screen him for Alzheimer's. Yes. What's your name? Buttons. Okay. Mm. Yeah.
So these mice, these Alzheimer's mice, have a very negative reaction to canola oil. That might mean that if you are a person, at least who's caring for a person who has Alzheimer's disease, get canola oil out of their diet. It's used incredibly often because it's so cheap. Go to olive oil, which apparently has the opposite effect and is good for people with Alzheimer's. But it might also mean that healthy people, if it translates, again, this is a big if, could have some negative effects of using canola oil, which is crazy because it's incredibly common. It's the most commonly used vegetable oil because it's cheap.
I don't use it.
And here's another thing.
I don't want to come off like a Greek, so I'm not going to be using olive oil either.
I think those are Romans. But Here's the other thing I've been thinking of. Even if we find out that canola oil is horrible for you, I don't think we're going to stop using it. I think canola oil has the best marketers on earth. And here's how I know that. There is no such thing as the canola plant. Do you know what canola oil is made out of?
I was actually just going to ask, what the fuck is a canola?
So this is why you know canola oil has a great PR firm. The plant that canola oil comes from is called the rapeseed plant.
How does it spread?
Not voluntarily. So literally,
it's raping your mom.
Yeah. Could you imagine? And this is, keep in mind, canola is not a recent thing. This would be like 100 years ago or something. Canola oil comes out, only instead of canola oil, it's called rape oil. Mm. Could you imagine if everybody, again, most common vegetable oil used, everybody in their cupboard right now had a product called rape oil?
Okay, but how does it work? Like, every woman might want to consider getting a rape whistle, but it doesn't summon rapists. It's...
Yeah, like,
does this
oil
prevent...
I guess.
It's real big in the fraternities.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, just get that rape oil in there. I think they have a great
lube.
They have a great marketer, so I think it won't even impact them. But if you get a chance, start getting rid of that canola oil. Switch over to olive oil. You'll do much better for yourself, especially if you have Alzheimer's disease.
I also recommend avocado oil. It's amazing. It's got a higher smoke point, and it's got avocados.
Absolutely. All right. Let's move on to everybody's favorite game, I Call BS.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
And yes, Damien, proven everybody's favorite game.
You and one person wrote an article. I need more of our fans to go out there and write more articles about this. And perhaps you need to name that perhaps the best part of the show isn't that game, but perhaps the great character work that's really brought onto the show, especially when summoning dead scientists.
Yeah, that's true. Good job, Allison.
Everybody. Everybody come onto the Mueller She Wrote page on Facebook and tell me how much you love this game.
Absolutely. All right. Let's start with article number one. New research suggests that people who live in very cold temperatures or very high altitudes have a much lower risk of cancer. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, but not for the reason you think. If you live in a very cold environment or a very high altitude, you're probably going to die before cancer can take you.
Why is that?
It's fucking cold and Sherpas are Sherpa, because the oldest man in the world, a fucking Sherpa.
Actually, those guys live pretty long. All right, and Allison.
Hot. I'm torn on this one because I know that athletes train in high altitudes. Mm-hmm. That's what blood doping is they train high altitudes, take their blood out. Yeah. and then put it back into them, which I think should be legal. You did the work. And it seems like those people would have, I don't know, more stamina, higher blood ox levels and things like that. And that the cold weather might prevent the spread. I'm not sure, but I'm going to say that this is science.
All right, article number two. A new form of matter has been discovered, and in true Bodie McBoatface fashion, the researchers who finally discovered it were so excited, they decided to name it excitonium. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. I think they could have come up with a lot better name. If they're going to throw the game, like the people who did named the gene Sonic the Hedgehog.
Right.
Those guys went all in.
Fair enough. So you thought it should be the Sonic the Hedgehog gene.
It could have been bonerific or rapeseed oil. That would be a great.
And Allison.
I'm going to say bad science, too. I think they would have come up with a much better. I mean, you know, they've named bugs after Gary Larson. I think they're just more creative than that. Plus, I think that when, scientists went and saw that Avatar movie, unobtainium really pissed them off.
Oh, we got to do it. All right. And article number three. It turns out that, like HIV, toxoplasmosis hijacks the immune system to mess up its host. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, although it does mess up the host, and that the host still most likely is a cat owner. It will inflict
they do
slow,
live in cats, yeah.
Painful life of a cat owner.
All right, and Allison.
Okay, can you repeat the first part of that for me, or just repeat the question?
It turns out that, like HIV, toxoplasmosis hijacks the immune system to mess up its hosts.
Yeah, bad science. I think it could mess up other parasites in the host, such as a baby, but the host itself, I think, is going to be fine.
All right, and lastly, article number four. New research suggests that Homo sapiens left Africa way further than previously thought, closer to 500,000 years ago. Damien, is this science or bad science?
You know, I feel like this question comes up an awful lot, and I don't think I've ever once had a good joke for it.
I mean, I could say that about most of I Call BS, but yeah.
You could, actually, with some accuracy, but I boycott this game for other reasons. Now, I'm going to say bad science, and that's because I'm going to play the man, not the game, as you say.
Uh-huh.
And you would have an erection right now if revolutionary news like this about Homo sapiens came out.
All right.
You have an uncontainable...
I have an uncontainable hominid erection?
Yeah. You cannot contain that. I'm looking at it. I'm trying to think of some sort of like penis Ziploc
container. The only thing that can contain this is a Homo floresiensis pelvis.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
All right, and Allison.
350 cc's in the throat, baby. Well, I know we were talking earlier about the little Ibu Gogos and maybe those guys that the guy busted the pelvis. Maybe they came up from Africa up to 700,000 years ago, but it's not really. I think the number's wrong, so I'm going to say bad science. I think the number's off, but I think it is earlier. I just think it's more earlier.
Right on. Okay, let's go back and see how you guys did follow along at home and see how you did. Article number one. New research suggests that people who live in very cold temperatures or very high altitudes have a much lower risk of cancer. Damien thinks this is false. Allison thinks this is true. And it is bad science. It is actually the opposite. They looked at a large data set and they found higher cancer rates in people in cold Nordic temperatures, whether those are Northern Europeans or Inuits, as well as people like the Andean Highlanders in Peru, which live in super, super high altitudes. It's the idea that there's this trade-off, that you have some kind of genetic protection against cold or high altitude, which we know those people have, and that that trade-off is somehow also probably not beneficial to you in terms of fighting off cancer. So you have gotten the ability to stand really, really cold temperatures or super high altitudes, but you've given up some kind of your protection for cancer.
So alpacas are more cancer-prone than sheep.
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
Now, it's theoretical as to how this is happening. Some things to be considered that weren't brought up in this article. If you live in the highlands, you literally have less atmospheric protection from cosmic rays. So you're bombarded by more radiation just living up there. So it might be that you get more radiation, so you're more likely to have cancer. I don't know if they controlled for that. It might be that if you're in super cold areas, you're inside with some kind of heating element that also contributes somehow to your cancer. If you're sitting there breathing air that has a little bit of methane or something in it coming off of a heater, maybe that increases your cancer risk too. We don't necessarily know that it's a genetic trade-off, but that's what they're postulating right now.
All right, sea level for the win.
Yeah.
That's right. Have they done any on below sea level people?
That would be an interesting one. We just go to Death Valley and find some...
It's called Death Valley. I bet the death rate is higher.
Just some methed out, just desert rat in there.
I was going there when I was thinking about if there was a crab song lyric into that. Under the sea, you expect to live 2 to 4 years longer because you're less prone to cancer.
Article number two, a new form of matter has been discovered in true Bodie McBoatface fashion. The researchers who finally discovered it were so excited they named it excitonium. Both of you guys thought this one was false, and this one is science. And it's a weird, weird form of matter, first theorized a half century ago. Very, very interesting. It's a condensate, which means it exhibits macroscopic quantum phenomenon like a superconductor or superfluid. That's really interesting. It might be something that we use for high-speed electronics later on. Very, very cool. Article number three.
Whoever named that, by the way, you're not a cool nerd.
Excitonium!
There's so many cool nerd stuff that they can name that shit after.
Excelsior! Pickle Rick!
Hogwarts.
I can't wait for the Pickle Rick of matter.
Yeah.
Article number three, it turns out that like HIV, toxoplasmosis hijacks the immune system to mess up its host. Both of you guys thought this one is false. And this one is science. Very interesting. We talked about toxoplasmosis before. Very interesting. It's a parasite that likes to breed in the stomach of cats. It gets shit out by the cats. A mouse eats that shit. Again, it wants to get in the stomach of a cat. So it hotwires the mouse's brain, turns off the fear inhibition of cats. The mouse runs up to the cat. Cat eats it. Now it gets back into the cat's stomach to breed.
Hotwiring a cat is pretty impressive.
Yeah, isn't it though? It's a Mexican mouse. So the...
oh, God.
But it also infects human beings. In fact, pregnant women are told to stay away from it because an infection with toxoplasmosis will kill the fetus. But a lot of populations...
Sweet home abortion. All
yeah, right.
Right?
A lot of populations do have a high rate of toxoplasmosis infection in human beings, especially ones that live around cats, places like Brazil and Egypt. And generally, it will give you kind of like flu-like, cold-like symptoms, but not do much more than that if you're a healthy, grown individual, if you're not pregnant. But there is some thought that it also inhibits human fear, and there are some interesting tantalizing evidence to that, including a lot of studies that show motorcycle crashes from reckless driving tend to happen disproportionately close to a toxoplasmosis infection. So maybe it's inhibiting our fear, we do stupid things, and we die. Interesting idea, not 100% proven yet, but this study looked at how toxo gets to the brain.
Is that why cat ladies are single?
Yeah. Well, actually, there is some thought that it does make them crazy.
It's Darwin.
Yeah.
And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, especially as they get older, because as they get older, their immune system is less able to hold it down, and that infection might cause some serious damage. That is an actual idea about crazy cat ladies. But how does it get from the stomach to the brain? That's an interesting question, because how do you get, how do you as a parasite that lives in a stomach affect the brain? That's actually, if you know biology, it's really hard to do. What they found is it hijacks the immune system. So toxoplasmosis gets in the stomach, it starts infecting it. Like any fungal infection, your body starts to fight it. So the immune cells come to the stomach to try and fight them. It gets onto the immune cells, the T cells, hijacks them, essentially gets into them, and then uses those T cells to cruise around the body until it finds the brain. Very, very interesting research. Very cool. And it might help prevent brain infections of toxoplasmosis, even in people who have gotten it in their stomach.
So they fly around your body, but they just don't know how to land.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Somebody will crash land in the right spot.
Do we have to leave through the butt? I feel like there's a lot of ways we could leave. Like, we control this thing like a fucking mech.
That's
we
right.
could leave the body anyway.
Now, you're talking about stomach, right? Not gut. Because I hear that there's all sorts of new studies talking about how the gut and the brain are connected.
Well, there and it would be probably gut as well, because you're talking about that whole intestinal system. But what you're talking about is more of the nerve connections, which would be a little bit different. And lastly, article number 4, new research suggests that Homo sapiens left Africa way further than previously thought, close to 500,000 years ago. Both of you guys thought this one was false, and this one is... bad science, meaning that I don't even know who our winner is. I'm not even going to mention it, but we'll just say that is bad science. Indeed.
No, I think we know.
No, I
think you've given a pretty heavy clue to our fans who've been with the show.
I lost track of who said what. I don't remember.
So congratulations, Damien.
I don't. But this is based on a true article. This is based on one that revised our output to about 120,000 years. Now, we have talked on the show before about an exodus out of Africa 120,000 years ago into the Middle East that didn't. We don't know that it went that much further. More and more, we've been finding more and more skeletons around, including in places like Eastern Asia, that indicate a Homo sapien or Homo sapien-like presence somewhere there, about 100,000, maybe even a little bit older than that. And this is basically a huge revision of the map. And some genetic tests seem to indicate that, yes, most non-Africans came from one gigantic migration that came out about 60 to 70,000 years ago out of Africa that accounts for basically all the people on the planet, if you mix in a little bit of different hominid DNA from Denisovans and Neanderthals. However, it looks like 120,000 years ago or so, there were little forager groups of Homo sapiens that left Africa. They left Africa into Asia, explored around, maybe bred with those other hominids, then maybe, even though they weren't huge contributors to our current gene pool, interbred with the later massive migration that came out that became the rest of humanity. Super, super interesting, because it might mean that there's some very divergent human genomes out there that are much more divergent than we would expect from any non-Africans. That is very, very interesting. And your clue for that, by the way, was that 500,000 years ago. You guys remember that Homo sapiens only been around for 300,000 years, so it could not have made it out that long ago. So that was your clue.
Ah, but I said it was more.
That's right.
So I, even though I was right, I'm wrong. So I ran the board, so I win.
Double extra points.
Right.
I think you won anyway. I'm not sure. I wasn't keeping track, but I won anyway.
Don't you play spades? I went nil. I called it. I said I would get nothing right, and I did.
Golf score, bitches.
We are amending the rule book as we speak. This is some Middle Eastern Congress. This is.
Well, thank you guys for coming back for Science Faction 204, where you learned about Homo floresiensis, why Denmark is horrible, how we discovered the gay gene, why canola oil may be killing you, why people who live in cold climates or high altitudes have a higher risk of cancer, how a new form of matter was discovered, how toxoplasmosis makes its way from the stomach to the brain, how we may have revised the exodus of Homo sapien from Africa, and how Allison Gill always beats Damien in I Call BS. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 205.
How dare you doubt the existence of Sasquatch? I've almost been canoled by one.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.